Are we on? Too loud? Never too loud. The group we have back here to controls is such a nice group of guys. This one back there tonight. But I'll tell you what they did to me. One day I went back there to get the microphone, and they tried to give me an earbud for my hearing. And it wasn't an accident, I don't think. They've enjoyed that. Eric was the one who I think did that. Thank all of you for being here. This is not too loud. Seems loud to me. Sounds funny? Well, that's how I am. I can't do what?
It's bad for him, but it's fine.
Yeah. That's like, you know, someone says, can you hear in the back? And they say, yes, turn it down a little bit. So that's what you were thinking. We'll begin eventually in chapter 12 of Genesis for those who are visiting, and we have some with us tonight, and thank you all for being here and visiting with us. And so if you have a print or electronic Bible, somehow managed to get to Genesis chapter 12, and we'll be there in just a little bit. Let me make some general kind of comments about our study in Genesis and ask you a question or two, and we'll go from there. First of all, just remember we're looking here at a book that is kind of the history of the kingdom of God. And we got up through the flood, for those who are visiting, and then did chapter 11 last time. And the flood destroyed sinners, but the flood did not destroy sin. I don't know whether you think about it that way or not, but as soon as they get off the boat, sin's still there. So it destroyed sinners, but it did not destroy sin. Last time we talked about the genealogies mainly, I chuckled a little bit. Initially, I'd been scheduled to do chapters 10 and 11, and then Ben had something he had to do, so he wanted to trade with me. And I thought, well, that's good. 10 and 11 are, I thought, did a good job talking about the genealogies and the various connections there, but I was glad he was doing it, not in me, so it worked out real well from my standpoint. And I thought he did a good job with it. Why are the genealogies, why are the genealogies important for us to know some things about them? One thing in particular, you think of anything, why knowing about the genealogies may make a difference? Okay, so one of the things we need to keep in mind is the ancestry of Jesus and how that gets preserved down through there. Any other thing you think about that where genealogies, where knowing which tribe people are in makes a difference? Not for Genesis' sake, but in the Old Testament time.
For the priesthood.
And also some other roles, but particularly for the priesthood. And if you remember, when they came back from Babylonian captivity, if you think about in Ezra and Nehemiah, that excuse me, that when they came back from captivity, they had a hard time finding enough what we'd say certified priests, qualified people, priests to administer the sacrifices. So they had to verify, certify, if you will, that those were the that they were of the tribe of Levi. So it was important, and then probably some lesser things, but those are the two things I think about. And Jewish people historically then have probably been, I'm talking about on down to present time, have probably been more into genealogy than others. But for those two particular reasons, I think it's really significant. Most of all, because of the genealogy of Christ. And if you look in chapter 11 in verse 10, this is the beginning, the genealogy of Shem. Shem was 100 years old, and he begot Arphaxad, and that is Christ is from that lineage. And if you go then to the New Testament where you have the lineage of Christ, then you will find that. So it's an important kind of thing. Another thing I want to comment about, just a little bit about what we've talked about in the past. And we talked about this mainly after the Tower of Babel, that process. And that has to do with languages. And I'm not sure that this is all this significant from a spiritual standpoint. It's kind of something that's fascinated me for a long, long time. First of all, we have God talking to man. I don't know what language they used, but since it's God, that's not a problem. That's going to get worked out. But then languages develop. And just think about the significance of that from two standpoints. Number one, when we talked about the creation and the animals being created, and then that there is no one there who is a suitable mate for Adam, then God covered that with by making Eve. Well, somewhere along the way, somehow, language is developed. And who was it that we had here? I hadn't even thought about this. I've been thinking about languages for a long time. What's her name's father? Spoke one Sunday night, and you remember he had the languages. Minnie May's father from out in Washington. And he was using some things about language. But if you look in secular history, the whole thing about development of languages is really an interesting kind of thing. And from a creation standpoint, man can use languages, but not animals. Now, I know people, somebody will say, well, I know this monkey who can talk. But there are ways that they can be communicated with, but there's not a complex language. And it's just, to me, it just says something about God, man, and the creation, and how somehow the set of languages developed. And it's, as I said, it's just one of those things that sort of has stuck in my mind through the years. As we study, let me see if I want to say anything about tribes. I guess not. We'll deal with the genealogists some more as we go through here. But as we study Genesis, as well as all the Old Testament, I don't know about you all, but when I think about that, and I read whether it's in Kings, or we'll deal with this later in Genesis, as they come back from, as the Israelites travel, then they encounter people like the Hittites and the Edomites and all those otherites. And as I read those sometimes, I'm thinking, well, they're their enemies. Well, I know this, but it somehow doesn't click with me. They're also their what?
Relatives.
They're their relatives. Oh, you know, they all come from these same group of people. So it's interesting to me that it works out that way. We need to recognize that, you know, after the fall, after the creation, then the fall, then we had Seth, and all the descendants then come from him, Noah, and then the various others. So it's interesting to me how all that works out. The other thing before I get to chapter 12 that I would mention quickly is when we study a book like Genesis and some other books in the Old Testament, it should not be an intellectual kind of study, even though we can be intellectual in studying it. But we need to think about what lessons are there for me. What are the takeaways from these various things? There are principles that we find here. For example, when you study about Abraham, what out of Abraham is helpful to you today living as a Christian? His faith. I would assume faith is going to be the thing. That's what we know about Abraham, and we're going to talk about that just a little bit tonight, more obvious as the days pass. So let's think about, and not just in this class, but as you read and as you study, particularly Old Testament books, it's fine to deal with those in their historical perspective. It's fine to deal with those in content, but also try to think, well, what are the principles in that that help me live my life every day? What do I benefit from that? So when we think about the flood did not disrupt the thread of the ancestors of Christ. You know, we'll go all the way back to Seth. And then from Seth comes who? Related to the flood comes Noah. I don't mean immediately, but in that thread. So that thread continues, and then we come all the way down, then finally to Christ in that. So that's enough harangue about that. Anybody want to say anything about any of that? Or you just rather get on with what we're going to do? Can you all see me over here? Okay. Sheba over there. Okay. All right. At the end of chapter 11, Gene, we took up on Sunday. We pick up in verse 27 of the genealogies of Abram's father. He's Abram at that time. Who his various immediate family members are. Point out that Sarah was barren. She had no child. That Terah, the father of Abram, took his grandson Lot and the son of and the daughter-in-law of Sarah and Abram and all of them from Ur, and they go to Haran. Then at age 205 years, he died, which means then Abram sort of has a responsibility here. And then we begin with the things in chapter 12. Now, chapters 11 and 12, to me, are kind of the beginning of the second part of Genesis. You know, we deal with all those things we've talked about in the first part, but now we're dealing with the beginning of the Israelites and carried all the way through the end of the book. And it could also be referred to, and some writers do this, that this is kind of the story of Abraham. It's kind of a new beginning here. And there probably, as we think about Abraham, there are probably, not in chapter 12, about four things that I would think about as kind of highlights as far as Abraham is concerned. First of all, he was called by God to move. Second was the promise that was made to him and remade. Third, the covenants that God made with him, plural. Covenants that God made with him, and particularly the one where he changed his name. Circumcision was given as a seal for that. And then probably the fourth big thing that I would mention with regard to Abram, later Abraham, would be his faith in sacrificing his son Isaac. So those are kind of the highlights of this. And then again with Abraham or Abram and Abraham, we have God again speaking directly. You know, he did to Noah. He did to others, and then we have God speaking to him. Now, when we get to chapters 18 and 19, 17, 18, 19, it says the angel of the Lord, and I'm not going to be teaching those, so whoever teaches that can decide whether that's God or how that is. So, in chapter 12, then, they are in the area that we'll talk about in just a moment, and the Lord speaks to him. Now, before I read that, and I've got you sort of on edge to look at that, let me talk about Ur just a little bit, where they were. And this is from uninspired history and geography. So that means it may or may not be totally right. But I think it's pretty close to right. So they were in Ur of Chaldees. There were two Chaldean civilizations. Sometimes you'll find one Babylonian, the other is Chaldean. But they were in Ur, in the area of what then was known as Mesopotamia. They lived perhaps, at the time of the Sumerian civilization. And I'll tell you in a minute why I'm going through this, because I think it is germane. The Sumerian civilization was a very prosperous one. It was in the area of the river valley of the Euphrates. Was a trading center, probably surrounded by fields that were irrigated because they had the river there. And it was an area where there was a lot of materialism. And then the other thing about that area is idolatry. If you remember in Joshua chapter 24 and verse 14, Joshua, relating to some other things, said about that their fathers before the river were idol worshipers. So that's probably what is going on here. In fact, in this area of Ur, in the Samaritan area, there was something that some people have thought may have been the Tower of Babel. I don't know about that. If you remember from your high school or college history in a Western civilization kind of class, you might have been had a little bit of reading about a building that is called a ziggurat, and it was thought to have a lot of different layers, levels, and not like a pyramid exactly, but the base was a lot larger, up to a smaller top. And the thing that's noteworthy about this, that particular structure was the home for the city's patron god, and that was the moon god, Nanna, N-A-N-N-A. Now, why note all this? Well, I think all of these things relate as to why God told Abraham to leave where he was. It was very prosperous. As we might say today, materialism was probably rampant there, and idolatry was certainly rampant there. So the conclusion could be drawn that for an ancestor of the Savior would not be a good place for that person to grow and to have his family there. So God came to Abram and told him to leave, and he makes this long journey. And you can look in geography books and other things and see a route that he may have taken. It's like the route they took from Egypt to the Promised Land. There are different views about where that route was. So to me, it's not so significant the route they took, but what happened. And when God told him to get up and go, what did he do? He got up and went. He heard and he obeyed. But I want to talk about this other just a little bit, as I have done, because I think it says something about why God wanted him to be in a location other than where he was. And again, it had to do maybe with materialism, and it had to do with idolatry. So now to chapter 12. I knew we'd get there, Gene. In chapter 12, now the Lord said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now this is also repeated in some other places. If you will, turn over to the book of Acts just a minute. To chapter 3 first in the book of Acts. Now, this is the three-part promise that God makes to, he's still Abram at this time. In Acts chapter 3, Acts chapter 3 is where Peter is preaching. And I won't do the whole thing, just down to verse 25. He said, you are the sons of the prophets and of the covenant which God made with our fathers, saying to Abraham, and in your seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And you notice that seed is singular. We'll talk about that some more later. Then turn over to chapter 7. Chapter 7 is where Stephen is making his defense before they stone him to death. And one of the things that he does in his defense is to just rehearse all of the much of the history of God's people. And he begins this in verse 2 of chapter 7. Verse 1 is just the introduction of the high priest. And this is Stephen now. And he said, verse 2 of chapter 7, brethren and fathers, listen. Here he goes. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he had dwelt in Haran. And he said to him, get out of your country, from your relatives, and come to a land that I will show you. Then he came out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Haran. And from there, when his father was dead, he moved him to this land in which you now dwell. And God gave him no inheritance in it, not even enough to set his foot on. But even when Abraham had no child, he promised to give to him for a possession and to his descendants after him. But God spoke in this way, that his descendants would dwell in a foreign land, that they would bring them into bondage and oppress them 400 years. Obvious a reference to Egypt. Verse 7, and the nation to whom they would be in bondage I will judge, said God, and after that they shall come out and serve me in this place. Then he gave him the covenant of circumcision, and so Abraham begot Isaac and circumcised him on the eighth day, and Isaac begot Jacob, and Jacob begot the 12 patriarchs. So we had the initial statement that God made to Abraham in the 12th chapter, and then we see these two references to it, and there are some more maybe we'll look at a little later tonight in addition to the ones we looked at in Acts. So when we think about this promise in Genesis chapter 12, let me begin by saying that when I did the third chapter of Genesis, I said that in my opinion this chapter is the theme of Genesis, and in some ways the theme of the entire Bible, because that's where you remember after they had sinned in the garden that there's the curse, and one of the things he said to them in the curse was the Redeemer would bruise the head of the serpent, his heel. Well, it seems to me that chapter 12 is the primary chapter that begins the implementation of what we read about in chapter 3. And then we see this further in, well, God reiterates that Abraham in chapter 18 and also in chapter 22. And then he makes the same promise to Jacob. To Esau in chapter 26 and Jacob in chapter 28. So we might come back to that a little later. Now, three parts of this. Well, first of all, I certainly don't want to belittle what goes on here, but I have thought in practical terms. Here he is with his family in Ur of Chaldees, which, as I've talked about, if the secular people are right, was a pretty good place to live as we measure things. And God tells him to get up and go. Well, if you had been, you can pick whichever member of that party you want to, Abraham, Lot, Sarai she was then. If you were told that, what kind of questions would you come to your mind? Why? What else? What?
Are we walking?
How are we going to get there? Where are we going?
For how long?
All these kinds of things. Well, what does Abraham do? Or Abram is then? He just got up and went. On a sort of a lighthearted note, I can just imagine. No, I can't imagine. Coming home one day and say, Rose, we're moving. And don't ask me where, how, or when. We're just going. Now, that's not really in my opinion, that's not really a silly kind of thing. That's a serious kind of thing. We don't know how long they've been where they are. We don't know how long they've been in Mesopotamia, but they've been there a while. And, you know, you have some roots. They were probably not as rooted then as we are now. However, if he is there at the time of the Sumerian civilization, it certainly would not have been nomadic like it turns out later. But the thing that I would emphasize about this, which is obvious, he had a lot of faith. Back in those days, people didn't travel much. You know, now you say, well, have you ever been to Laramie, Wyoming? Yeah, we've been there six times. Well, you know, they wouldn't travel a lot. I read something several years ago that Ed Harrell wrote, and I, you know, this is just his idea. He said in medieval period, people didn't travel more than 10 miles from home at any time. Now, that's probably may or may not be right. When they get to the promised land, they're more nomadic. But these people were sedentary probably here. So God says to him, get up and go. As far as we know, Abraham did not raise a question. Abram, I'm sorry. He didn't raise a question. He just went. Yes, ma'am. Well, that's true. Brenda's comment was, it's not another human being that was saying that to him. And that's a good point. Yes. Well, you know, we know that there was idol worship there. As I noticed in the passage in Joshua, that the fathers, his ancestors, had been engaged in idolatry. Sharon, I think that's a really reasonable question and one that I've thought about. You know, we don't know. There's no background about that. And oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to quote you. Did Abram have any belief in God? So we're not told anything about that. Obviously, he did soon. If he didn't, he didn't then. So he went. And not only that, he didn't know what. Where he was going. So all of that took a lot of what? Faith. It took a lot of faith. And, pardon?
Courage.
And courage, okay.
And energy.
And, well, yeah, it took all those things. But just to take off, it took a lot of faith. And, you know, there are several passages, we might note some later, about his faith. And because of his faith, at least in two or maybe three places in Scripture, he's referred to as a friend of God, which, again, is something that we might aspire to. So God tells him to go, and then here's what he's going to do. I'll make you a great nation. So the fulfillment of that is what? What's a great nation? I'm sorry? No, but I'm saying, what is the fulfillment? What becomes a great nation? Israelites. Now, as we look, and if you look in history, if you look in a world history, world civilization, Israel doesn't get much space in there. In the world picture, Israel would have reached its greatest height at the time of Solomon. And Solomon did pretty well. But when we read as a great nation, put that one in the right kind of context. Then he says, and I'll show you a land, and I will make you a great nation. I'll show you a land. And then in verse 3, I will bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. And this is the real, you've got a land promise, you've got a nation promise, and then that all people of the world will be blessed. Now, do you think Abram grasped what that meant? I don't know how he could have. And neither do people for a long, long time. And of course, that ultimately comes as a reference to the what? Christ. And Christ coming. And that's the reason I said earlier, if you go back to chapter 3, this is the first step toward the implementation of that. So these are the promises that he made to him.
Not only did he not understand it, he may not have even wanted that. You know, I mean, I'm fine right here. Thank you very much. You know, I don't want to be a great nation. I don't want it. But he had the faith to say, stay around. That's what God wants.
Right. Paul's point is that maybe Abraham thought, well, that's not what I want. I want to stay here. But, pardon? Yeah. Right.
Who else is God talking to besides
Abraham? Noah. Yeah. He hasn't talked to. But, you know, they would not. I'm assuming that not a lot of people would have known who God had talked to. There's no way to get that out. So, the other thing that I would mention about this, and the fulfillment of this, of course, is the coming of Christ. And this is the reason I would say, to reiterate what I said earlier, chapter 3, I think, is the key theme of all this, and then chapter 12, and these first three verses, in particular verse 3, is the implementation of that. And then I read a moment ago that passage in Acts 3:25, and that's what Peter was dealing with there. Then in Galatians, to kind of round all this out, in Galatians chapter 3, Paul there says in chapter 3, in verse 8, Galatians chapter 3 and verse 8, "And the scriptures, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel to Abraham beforehand, saying, in you all the nations shall be blessed. And then in 14, "And the blessing of Abraham might come upon the Gentiles in Jesus Christ, that we might receive the promise of the Spirit through faith." So I think it's significant to notice that, because all these others were references as far as Israelites are concerned, but he said all nations, and that included the Gentiles. If you go back to Acts chapter 1, verse 8, when Christ has appeared to his apostles after the resurrection, before the ascension, he told them that, you know, they must represent him in Jerusalem, in Judea, and Samaria, and the whole world. So this is a promise then that is made to all, and us Gentiles today should be thankful for all that. So the three things that it promises: a great nation, a land promise, and then that all people would be blessed through that. The seed promise, yes, sir. Now, what led Abraham to do this? Faith. And one of the takeaways, it seems to me, from when we read this chapter, is what a great example of faith that Abraham is. I guess a takeaway from that is that we have a goal. We have an example that should... that we should try to live by and to emulate. Abraham left Haran when he was 75 years of age with Lot, and he would go where God would direct him. And then let's read a little more here in verse 4. "So Abraham departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him, and Abraham was 75 years old when he departed. Then Abram took Sarah his wife, Sarai, and Lot his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan." Now, the land of Canaan is going to be inhabited by people who are going to be receptive to these nomads coming through? Not too much. Verse 6, "Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem." And if you don't know Shechem, just drive a peg down there, because Shechem is going to be one of the places that plays a great part in things between now and the end of the book. And then he goes as far as the oak tree of Moreh. "And the Canaanites were then in the land." And 7, "Then the Lord appeared to Abraham and said to him, your descendants, I will give this land." And there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. Now, Sharon, I'll come back to that on your question a minute ago, because it relates, I think, to that. So they are moving along in this land, and he says, "Your descendants, I'll give this land." Now, Did Abraham own any land? Did Abraham ever have any land in the promised land?
He bought the land the tomb was on.
Okay, Machpelah. He brought the land where his wife's buried, and an irony in that one. Who else? Whose bones are put there?
Joseph.
You remember when Joseph was about to die in Egypt, he got his brothers around and he said, "Now one of these days, everybody's going to leave here and go back home." Which I'm sure at 400 years they thought, "Well, what does he know?" But he said, "When you go, you are to take my bones back and bury them there." And that's what took place. Does Abraham have any other land in the promised land? As in chapter 7 where we read, Stephen said he didn't have a place to put what? To put his foot. So did God not live up to what he promised him?
He promised his offspring he had it.
Okay. There wasn't a personal promise here, but his offsprings. And then, as he said here, when they're there, these are going to be for your offsprings, for your descendants. So, this is a land of Canaan. The ancestors will not find it very friendly. Then in 7, 8, and 9, 8, and he moved from there to the mountains east of Bethel, and he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east, and there he built an altar of the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. So Abraham journeyed, going on still toward the south. Two or three things in that. First of all, there are two more sites here that you need to sort of put a peg down. One is Bethel. And Bethel is a place that Abram comes back to more than once. Ai, we know mainly from what? One of the battles that takes place there when they try to conquer the promised land. And for a long, long time, skeptics of the Bible would say, well, nobody has ever found Ai, with all the archaeological digs that have taken place. Well, some years ago, some think that they have found the area of Ai. So, God makes this promise in 7 and 8, 9. He really sort of renews this promise. And Abram then builds altars at these two places. Sharon, I don't know how he knows to build altars. I don't know what he offers on the altars. And when he, the first record we have of him building altars are the ones we read here. So I don't know. Again, God may have instructed him somewhere along the way. It's somewhat like Cain and Abel. It would appear from a passage in the New Testament that God had indicated them what they were to do, but we're not told that directly. So, maybe somewhere along the way, Abram had been so advised, but he builds these altars. Second thing about the altars, the altar is kind of a form of pattern of where he traveled. Now, we only have in this reading today two sites where he did altars. But it's it kind of is his trail, if you will. So, let's look at one other thing before we maybe get into the last part of this chapter. If not, we'll pick that up on Sunday. Let's look at where God... then renews these promises. Turn over to chapter 22, if you will, of Genesis. Genesis 22, beginning in verse 15. And now this is where Abraham, he is now, makes the effort to offer Isaac as a sacrifice. 22 and 15. Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time out of heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies." Verse 18, "In your seed all the nations of the earth will be blessed because you have obeyed my voice." So again, that reaffirms what he had said to him earlier about seed. Then look in chapter 26. Abraham is dead. Isaac is now on the scene. And there's a famine, believe it or not. Chapter 26, verse 1, there was a famine in the land besides the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went to Abimelech, king of the Philistines in Gerar. Then the Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land of which I shall tell you. Dwell in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For you and your descendants I give all these lands." There's a land promise. "And I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham your father. And I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to you, your descendants, all these lands. And in your seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, and my statutes, and my laws." So again, he's repeating the same thing. But in both of these cases, what we read in 22 and 9, 26, and we'll read another one, 28. In both of these things, he said, "I'm doing this because of what?" The faith of Abraham. Now, let me just say to us, have you ever thought, if you just take back earlier, we were talking about all of the kind of the overlords, you know, the Methuselahs and all those who had lived so long and had all of these children. Have you ever thought about the opportunity they had with all those children to just influence generation after generation after generation? Well, the one that we see who did that is who? Is Abraham. Now, that's not to say others didn't. Obviously, Enoch was in good standing with God. Noah was. But just think about the opportunity to influence people over a long period of time. If that was true then, when else is that true? Today. For those of us who have children, grandchildren, if you don't have any children, you have an opportunity to influence other people. So one of the things that almost makes me mushy about these is it says, because of the faith of Abraham. Look in chapter 28. This is now the promise renewed to Jacob. Chapter 28 and verse, how about 13? 28 and 13. This ironically is at Bethel. Again, Bethel is one of those map locations where a lot of things took place. "And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, 'I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give you and your descendants. And also your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west, to the east, to the north, and the south. And in you and in your seed, all the families of the earth shall be blessed.'" So we have this three times now. Four times, including Acts chapter 7, that all people of the earth will be blessed because of what Abraham did. Now, here with Jacob, he does not add that caveat on it, but he includes seed in all these. And then when you get to the New Testament, in Paul's writings, he said seed as one, not as seeds, because the seed goes back to the beginning. Goes back to the ones that Christ is descendant of. So the seed there. So then it says, and we'll pick up here on Sunday, then it says, going back to chapter 12, that he continues to go toward the south. And what we won't take up tonight, because the bell's going to ring in a minute, it has to do with him going down into Egypt. And we'll pick up with that. Chapters 13 and 14 don't have as much in them as chapter 12 did. I mean, there are a lot of words in there, but other things. But he goes down into Egypt, and we see a little different. Sam might come in. We have a little different picture when it comes to Egypt then. And one of the things have any of you ever heard a sermon on where is your Egypt or what is your Egypt? I've asked that before. Nobody's ever heard that. I know I've heard a sermon about that, but I guess I dreamed it. I don't know. But the point is, we have Abraham going to Egypt. Who else goes to Egypt? Joseph goes to Egypt. Now, not by his own choice, but he goes. But then when we read about Jacob, God told him, don't do what? Don't go to Egypt. Now, Egypt is kind of their safety valve, if you will. It's their escape. And we all sometimes in our lives have an Egypt because we're looking for an out. And according to my phone, it's about time for the bell to ring. Anybody want to say anything since I've talked most of it tonight? Thank you all for being here, and see you Sunday on 13 and 14. End of 12.